It is February 24th, 1993. I am Marilyn McCarney. Betsy Payette and I are checking with Ed Miller for verification of the various programs at Renfrew Museum and Park since 1975.
I really think that what Mrs. Nicodemus saw, the potential of that house, there was memories that she had of the house when she was a little girl growing up. She remembers coming to the Antietam Creek fishing with her father. And I believe that she was inspired by that. Her father never really held a responsible job, but he was very inventive in his mind. Worked and tinkered at many different things, but never really established much of anything. And he would take the girls and go to the East Branch of the Antietam to fish. And I can only guess at what Mrs. Nicodemus saw in that house at that time as a little girl growing up.
Now, physically, what did she see? What was it like, did you think, at that time?
Visibly what she saw was something that reminded her of the past. She always was looking at something that came from years before.
But what was actually standing?
The house, the existing house that's there now. Now this, we're talking about 40 years prior to her marriage. Mm-hmm. We're talking about when she was probably only 10, 12 years old. There was a smokehouse, which she probably would have called the butcher house, mm-hmm. the main house, which is standing today, and the spring house, and the big white barn that's there today. All of the buildings that are there now was there at that time, plus a few others that have since been torn down.
Do you remember what they were, just out of curiosity?
Right, there was a turkey house.
Now, what's a turkey house?
A turkey house is just like a poultry house or chicken house. The only thing they raised turkeys in that instead of, it was longer than a normal chicken house. There was a summer kitchen, which was south of the kitchen that exists today. Mm-hmm. That was on that little elevation right back of the house where we had the concerts. There was a summer kitchen there. There was a coal bin on the outside. There was a forge, mm-hmm. a little building that housed welding. Instead of going to a welding shop, they did it by melting two pieces of iron and mm-hmm. molding them together. There was another small chicken house that was converted into a garage. And that sat between this new spring house that was refurbished and rebuilt and the garage. There was a shed that sat in there. There was also a chicken house at that point. Now I remember this. One of the things I was always fascinated with this chicken house that was there, it was later moved, was this concrete basin in the yard of the chicken house. And that was their place to water the chickens. Instead of having water fountains, they had this concrete basin. I never could quite figure out why they had that, because that had been very dangerous for peepees, small chickens, yeah. because they would have drowned in that. But here was this basin, and that's where the, and I'm sure they had ducks and geese and all the things that went with that, and probably was intended for their use too, but they used it for their drinking fountain. But I think when those are the buildings that all that I can remember.
How much of the mill would have been left? Or just
at that time, the mill would have been standing in its fullest. Mm-hmm. It would have been completely there because it was torn down in the 20s. So the mill, There was also a Miller's House, a brick story and a half house that's down towards the mills where the grist mill foundation is now. There was a story and a half brick house built at that location.
There you go.
You don't see that until you walk back. You have to be close because now it's grown up with all these tree of heaven that grows up like shrubs, bushes thick. The foundation is still there, and the cistern to that house is still there. And I remember that in 1943 was one of the most vivid things in my memory, another one of the most vivid things. They decided to tear that down, and I wondered why. Because it had so much potential to fix it up and keep it for posterity. But there had to be a choice made. So they prioritized and put all their resources into refurbishing the brick, the stone portion, or the stone house. The old barn, of course, was still usable, where we rebuilt the Fahnestock barn today. There was a visible area where possibly where the Renfrew sisters lived, and there was an indentation in the ground. We never dug that up. Hopefully someday we will, just find whether there was a foundation and how big this house was. Now, at that time, there could have been portions of that foundation still existing in the 30s, 20s or 30s. But the brick house that I was referring to is the Miller's house. That was torn down, and the bricks that you see in the walkway and the brick patio in the back came from that house. But I always thought, nobody was living in it at the time it was torn down. I guess it just seemed a shame because it was very unique how it was built, and probably the bricks that that house was built with came and was burned right on that property, as supposedly the bricks in the Fahnestock house today was burned and built on site.
In what sense was it unique?
The Miller's house, the Miller's house was unique, as I recall it. It's vague, but as I recall it, it reminded me, other than the bricks, when you walked into it, you walked into the past of an adobe house, had like two rooms, and the only access you had to the loft was a ladder, no steps. Mm. It was just a hole in the ceiling. It ran north and south, and in the southwest corner was an opening in the ceiling with a ladder going up to that loft. Two little windows at each end of that house. Now, you could not have stood up in that over here in the corner. You'd have to moved over towards the center before you could have stood clear up in that house. But that was unique. It reminded me of a log cabin, only this one had bricks. It reminded me of the past and how their children probably slept up there. They were simple enough to crawl up a handmade ladder to get to the loft. But it was a very small house, so there couldn't have been a large family lived in. I doubt if that house is more than, it might have been 30 feet long.
But actually, five houses stood on that property. The Fahnestock house, the Renfrew house, the Miller's house, the Nicodemus house, and your house. So five houses. Which three are still standing.
Right. Now, there was also another house. There was a log house where the museum stands today. That's why the museum house was built in two stages. The main house, the forebay, was built first. Then there was a west wing added to that, and it was completed about 1850. The reason for that west wing being added, there was a log house on the property where the children were raised. Most of them had been grown up, married, and away from the family before the stone house was built in the early 1800s. But you can see down in the basement where the foundation wall changes. In the west wing of that house, the foundation is not as thick as it was in the main house, although it was a 2.5-story house.
Was the log part incorporated into it, or were they taken down?
No, it was taken down, and it looks like they used that shallower wall to build the stone addition.
Because we found on campus that there was a log house, and that it was incorporated into the old house there, so that the inside is log and the outside is stone.
No, this one was not incorporated in. There was also a bake oven. Now, we don't know the exact location of that, but we feel that it would have been close to the summer kitchen and close to the spring house, between those two buildings, and it would have been very close to the log house that existed at the time the stone house was built. As the Royers moved there in 1788, he bought the property in 1777 because he wasn't married at that time. And I think it's 10 years later that they're married and move into the log house that was there when they bought the first 150 acres. And so that's basically, I think, what Mrs. Nicodemus saw too. She looked back and it brought back a lot of memories of days gone by. But she was always, you had to know Mrs. Nicodemus to appreciate the way she thought and the way she felt about old things. And I think that came from her father. Never heard them talk much about their mother. Never asked many questions, I guess. I never asked many questions about her mother or father, but she would talk about how her father fished constantly. And, you know, sort of an eccentric kind of individual. And I think people with inventive minds could all be considered sort of eccentric. Probably not any more eccentric than anybody else, but their mind's always working. And I think that's what inspired Mrs. Nicodemus from the day she saw that, was her grandmother inspired in her at 10 years of age. She gave her her first old piece of furniture, which was an old rocking chair. And from that moment on, she started to collect things that was old. And that's the reason, I think, when she went to see the Antietam, there had been a lot more woods there than there is today. And the stream itself was fascinating, and I'm sure that old house, which at that time would have had a picket fence down in front of it instead of the stone wall that's there now. We have a 1909 or 1910 picture that shows a picket fence in front of the museum.
I ask that because I can think of two houses in this area that I've seen, Bessie recalls, one of them that Charlie Warner brought. And it was not so much the house as the site. And then by Welty's Mill, there is a house that has a mansard roof. And it's the house, not the site. It's a terrible site.
Mm-hmm.
But the house is nice. So I was wondering whether she was seeing the house or the site or both.
I would think it would have been both. I would have think, knowing Mrs. Nicodemus as well as I think I knew her, I think it would have been both the site and the house that would have been very fascinating. It would have been very interesting to know how she really truly felt the first time she saw that place. Because, as I said, I think that it wasn't the only site that they looked at. They had looked at other sites. They were both at one other site that I know of in particular. And that was a stone house also, but there was no water. And I think that both Mr. and Mrs. Nicodemus decided on Renfrew because of water. And of course it had a stone house. And the other thing that's unique about this story, as I see it, They never could decide on what to name it. They both wanted to name a name for it. And one of those was Winding Creek. One was Willow Glen, because there was a lot of willow trees around at that time. In fact, that one used to come through on my water bill as the Willow Glen Farm. It never was officially named that, but it used to come through on the water bills, Willow Glen. And I think that's why Miss Nicodemus was very emphatic. And she didn't really want personal recognition. That's why I think she wanted it named Renfrew Museum and Park, which she suggested and put in her will that it would be called that. And she had insisted that if and when the borough accepted that, that she didn't really want any large plaques made up to identify other than to say it was given to the borough of Waynesboro by Emma G. Nicodemus and her sister Hazel F. Geiser. And it just, all things sort of went together. I think really being 10 years difference in their ages, I think also made her feel that she probably would have the decision to make what to do with the property after her husband's death. And I think that early on in their marriage, she had it all planned in her mind of what she was going to do with it. And very sincere, you know, about it all, because and her utmost thought was, we made our money in this town, I want to leave it to this town. And that's why she gave three choices too, because if, first of all, it was the state, and the state offered to the state, and the state turned it down, which they thought it should be locally owned, and then that's what made her decide to do that. And then the state was the second choice in the will. But it would be very interesting to know exactly how she felt about that. But as I said, I can only say what I think, knowing her as well as I knew her, and how she came about giving it to the borough of Waynesboro.
Do you know what the drop of the mill race is?
Yeah.
How did the race serve the mill? And that would lead to
okay. Well, the race, as you know, the site of the breast of the dam is approximately a quarter of a mile from the mill site. I say approximately because I don't know exactly how many feet. The mill race would have been rather deep in order to get water to flow into it from the creek site. I would think that the supply of water was more important than the fall and the elevation. The mill had two 14-foot overshot water wheels. That was according to a letter that we received from the Fonestocks in 1909. It was a letter written, and that was kept by the Nicodemus family, and that was recorded in 19. That letter was written in 1909. The steps to the spring, the smokehouse, as we call it today. Of course, that was a very versatile building. It not only was a smokehouse, it was the wash house, it was the butcher house, and then they used it thirdly for smoking their meat, curing their meat. But the stone steps that now come right straight down to the mill race, like this, on an easterly direction, at one time came from the south to the north, right down to the door, the front door of the smokehouse. So that would answer that question. My other question was, it's never been resolved in my mind, how did they utilize that building without water running in to the first floor of it? And so apparently the mill race was much deeper, but did not come up to the level of the first floor. But the length of that mill race was the important thing, because overshot water wheels did not take as much water as the undershot water wheel, because they could control that by shutting the water down and just leaving a certain amount come through. If they needed more, they opened it a little wider to get more power. So the water supply, the supply water was more important than the flow of the water. And that's why it was such a long mill race to store the water for their long-term use. Now, the wheels would only have operated when they were grinding. They would not have been run over long periods of time, but they would have been over periods during a day when they had a supply of water to do that with. It would be very nice if there would be some way, someday, we could rebuild a grist mill to the dimensions that was there. The person that has told us more about the mill site, the existing mill, when it still existed, was Whitey Minnick, who lived. I'm sure he's related this all to you. But he always said it was a three-story building made from brick, stone, and wood. And that's, I think you can substantiate that, because they would have had all those materials available to them, and that's what they would have used. The grist mill, I think, was very versatile. It ceased operating, I think, early 1900s, 1909, 1910, and then was dismantled and torn down in the 20s. I never saw the mill. Nobody seems to have any pictures of it, which is unfortunate. The artist concept of it doesn't look like the mill I would think that would have been there. But at least we have a concept. I would think that as most mills of that nature had height, because an elevator needs to have storage space that you can elevate the grain up, but that you can take it out by gravity. So that's why you'd have height instead of low areas. They didn't have any power, so they had to do it as best they could with the water wheel would elevate the grain up with little conveyor belts, but then to take it out, you just had tubes and take it out by gravity.
Are there any records as to what their output was?
Not to my knowledge. Not to my knowledge. Although it was also used as a creamery and as a gypsum mill. They apparently ground gypsum there for a short period of time. And it was also a station to pick up milk from the local farmers. Now, I don't know what they did with it after they had it. It doesn't seem to be any record of how they removed it from that point to the distribution point. I don't know that.
The reason I ask is that we learned recently that there were about 200 mills in Washington County, and which was kind of an astounding number.
Mm-hmm.
And none of them could have done a great deal of business with that many. And I was just curious as to what it's out for.
Well, there was actually, they didn't all do the same thing. White Mill at on the Mincer Gap Road and Fish and Game Road. Then you had Keggy's Mill at the Country Club site. Then you had the Bear Woolen Mill. And then you had the one at Renfrew, the Fauna Stock. You had one at Welty's, and you had one at Goods Dam. And that's all within about a mile and a half. And I think there was a lot of mills in those days, because they need to be near enough that the farmer could get there with horse and wagon.
Function of the difficulty of hauling.
Yeah.
And the fact that you don't need much of a drop.
That's right. Mm-hmm. One of the things that I think that prompted Mrs. Nicodemus again to really try to resolve so that there would be no glitches in this transition. This is the thought, and this tells you a great deal more about Mrs. Nicodemus in my way of thinking. A lot of people disagree with this, but my way of thinking, Mrs. Nicodemus said to her husband, you know, we were both married late in life. I feel that we ought to have separate wills. We will write these wills that everybody is taken care of as long as either one of us lives. But if you go first, I was 10 years older, and statistics support that the husband is not going to live as long as the wife. He said, I think you ought to give your money to your nieces and nephews, and you ought to make a separate will. And he agreed to that with this stipulation that only at the time of her death would that distribution be made. She would live off of the income from his estate as long as she lived, but at her death, then his estate was divided between the nieces and nephews.
A life interest, that's called, yeah.
Right. And Mrs. Nicodemus said, then what I will do, that will give me the choice to do with this what I want. And to my knowledge, I don't think Mr. Nicodemus probably ever asked the question, what are you going to do with it? I don't think he really... Not that he didn't care, but he wasn't that interested in knowing. He was agreeable on that setup. And so whatever she decided, I'm sure at that point in her life, when they made their wills, she did not know exactly what she wanted to do. And as I told you on my original interview, that for 4 years before her death, there was never a day went by when we didn't talk about what was going to happen to her home and her collection. And that included Sunday morning, because I would have Sunday morning breakfast with Mrs. Nicodemus. And that was a 7 day a week, almost every day without exception, when she was home. And we didn't talk about things that, well, maybe this could go wrong or that could go wrong. What should we do to prevent that from happening? I don't think anybody ever spent more time in making a final will than what Mrs. Nicodemus did. And I was very proud to be a part of that, you know, the trust that she had in me to share all of those things with me. And never, I don't think she ever questioned that it wouldn't stay that way. As I told you in my other interview, that she swore me to secrecy that I couldn't even tell my wife, which was the hardest thing about this whole thing, that I felt like a sort of a traitor in a way, and I thought, gosh, this is a terrible thing to ask somebody to do. But I respected her wishes and kept that secret to the day she died. And so a lot of things that's happening at Renfrew today, you know, I look back and I say, Lord, who would have ever thought that all of these things now would come to fruition 20 years, almost 20 years later, 19 years it would be this summer. And I think of how she planned this thing, because she was a meticulous person. She never left a stone unturned. And sometimes it would drive you crazy, because why is it so important? But it was important, and now I realize it more than ever, how important it was, because she did not want anything to go wrong with what she wanted to do with it. And from that standpoint, I have much more admiration for her and her ability to think things through Because I too sometimes thought that, gee, some of these things made you think, is she a little eccentric too? And I say that in all due respect, because those thoughts did pass through my mind. But she never gave up. And she always continued to think, well, if we don't do this, what might happen? And I said, well, you know, from a legal standpoint, I don't know. Those are the kind of things that we would talk about, then she would take it to the attorney and say, well, I think we ought to put this in. And so I'm sure that it was changed many times and many trips were made before the final will was drafted.
At the time she bought the place, where did Waynesboro end? Waynesboro now runs essentially into Renfrew.
Right. The borough line at that time was right about where Northeast Avenue is.
This would have been 1940.
That would have been about the time when the YMCA, it would have been later than that, because then they extended it out to 2nd Street, because that's a borough street. See, the schools are now annexed into the borough. So the borough line actually runs on the right-hand side of the road, runs a little bit further than it does. The borough line still ends on the left-hand side going east at Northeast Avenue.
But when they bought it then, they were not in Waynesboro.
We're still not.
And you're still not.
Still not.
But in just the physical sense, you would say, I live in Waynesboro. You would say, I live outside of Waynesboro.
Right, right.
And it would have been a substantial walk to get to Waynesboro.
Yeah.
And now Waynesboro has crept out, but as you say, it hasn't yet.
Right.
It's used to
well,
Washington Township.
It's still, you know, this farm, Eastland Hills, is in Washington Township. Renfrew is all in Washington Township. But the Holland Green Farm is annexed into the borough. So that is borough. And that runs clear around, surrounds us. The borough surrounds us clear over to Fran Lauer's place there on Weldy Road. That's all in the borough.
Was this done on purpose? Did they seek to stay in, to stay as an enclave? Or did they try to do that? Or
As far as Renfrew goes, well, there was no reason to annex it in to the borough, because there's no tax base to start with. The only tax base we would have is the house that I live in. So there was no real reason to do that. And of course, they stopped annexation by choice when this property, Holland Green property, was annexed into the borough. It now has to be put on referendum. It has to be voted in instead of just arbitrarily being entered into the borough. That's, you might not want to record this,
yeah,
what I'm going to say now. Well, as I said, Mr. Nicodemus was not interested in orchards as much as he was horses, but he followed his father's instructions and he moved to Zellinger and he managed the orchard, and then went to France and bought some horses and started to raise Percheron horses. And he was very successful at that. He used the Percheron horses to do the farm work. It was the basic reason originally to buy the horses. And he wanted horses that could pull 400-gallon, 500-gallon sprayers through the fields and the hills and the terrain that was located there. And then it got to be more of just having workhorses, why not show them? And so he had a boy that he took under his wing, the name of Charles Helfrich. And he took him under his wing when he was about 16 years old. His father had died and he was living with his mother, and so he moved in one of the tenant houses and lived with one of the farmers. And he taught him how to take care of these horses, the breeding end of it, prepping them for a show, And that was his whole life. And he worked for him all of his life until he retired. And showed these horses, we'd take them to Harrisburg. I think I did say this before. We took them to Ohio. And when we'd take them to Greencastle, we sometimes would walk them to Greencastle to put them on the train. We always traveled by freight train. We had a boxcar that was adapted to put these horses on, and somebody traveled with them right in that car. So we'd go to Chicago, Columbus, Ohio, Timonium, Harrisburg. Those are the four that I remember. There could have been others, but those are the four that I remember of going, taking the horses to, and walking them to Greencastle one or two times. Then after that, we had a truck that we delivered them by truck and then transported them on the train.
He's raising draft horses at a time when this steam tractor is already in, and the motor tractor is coming in, and
right.
So it becomes less a business and more of a passion.
Right.
That's the wrong word, but more of a...
Well, become more of a hobby.
Yeah, a hobby.
After the tractors came in, they started to buy tractors, and tractors wasn't too dependable at that time, so they maintained horses to carry through. But then the tractor became better, and he maintained the horses, and then added thoroughbreds, and raised his own thoroughbreds, trained them on the farm. And this Charles Helfrich that I was talking about worked with the draft horses. He married then, had a son who helped to train the race horses at the orchard. We always kept these horses at the orchard. We never had them here. And we had lots of horses, 20-some draft horses, and probably 15, 20 thoroughbreds. And each year at that point in time, racing, of course, was not in Pennsylvania. So you had to breed them in Maryland to race them in Maryland. They also had to be born in Maryland. So we had a horse trailer, and when it come time to breed them, we'd take them to Maryland. When it come time for them to foal, you took them back to Maryland so they'd be born and bred in Maryland, to race them in Maryland. And that was pretty much a hobby. And he had, I don't remember the year, but it was in the late 30s, and the horse picture that you see in the Nicodemus room, Sir William, was the grand champion stallion of the United States. And of course that put him as a very prominent purcher and dealer. But again, Mr. Nicodemus was a very laid-back individual and just took all of those things in stride. And one of the little anecdotes that I remember, Dutch Helfrich, we called Charles Helfrich, was called Dutch. Dutch went to Harrisburg to show the horses and didn't get a ribbon. And he was sort of down about that, couldn't understand why he didn't even get a mention. And Mr. Nicodemus walked over to him and says, "Don't worry about it, boy." He said, "Boy." He called him boy. "Don't worry about it, boy. We'll take him home, we'll fix him up, and we'll go to Columbus, Ohio." Took him to Columbus, Ohio, and won first, second, and third. You know, he said, "If you don't win the first time you go back, you keep trying, you get what you want." And he did know the horse business. And he was an avid rider himself, rode horseback up to he was about 75 years old. But he loved his horses. And he loved the orchard business, after it grew on him. And his father, to go back again, his father was a very imaginative person. He understood you needed to have apples refrigerated if you wanted to keep them and hold them for a better price. You refrigerated them. And there wasn't a lot of areas around that you could do that. Winchester, Virginia was a large area where they had lots of storage facilities. Waynesboro Ice and Cold Storage didn't come into being until sometime in the 20s. That it got built one section, then they built something else. And my home was one of the Nicodemus's properties. The house I was born in belonged to the Nicodemus family. My father went to work for them in 1918, 2 years after they converted an old mill into a coal storage, put a 1916 Frick compressor in that building to refrigerate around 18,000 bushel of apples. The capacity of that storage is around 18,000. My father operated that until it was closed in 1945. The 1916 Frick compressor was used in that whole period of time and is still in that building. Not usable, but it's still there. The horses, again, we go back to the horses. It was a dry fall. We always turned the horses out in the orchard after the apples were all picked so they could eat the apples that was laying on the ground. We had it fenced off, had it sectioned off where you have your mares and your stallions separated. And this dry fall, after the apples were picked, they turned the horses out, and then it turned into be a rainy season. Between the lead, the arsenic of lead that was used in the spray, the horses got distemper along with that. And the two diseases wiped out about 19 of the horses that he had. Did not kill the stallion that Sir William that won the best, the grand champion. He was in a different section of the orchard. It did not affect him. And he lived to be about 25 when they had to destroy him. But he lost about 19 of those heavy horses and thoroughbreds at that period of time. And that ended the Percheron business. There was two or three that survived, and they just kept them till they died. But that's how the horses died. They felt distemper or the traces of arsenic would not have killed them separately, but the combination of the two destroyed their respiratory system.
We'd like to have a log of all the programs that have been held at Renfrew Museum and Park since 1975, and we had a few questions about who was responsible for them and what were some of them. So can you kind of tell a little bit about who was planning for this at that time?
Well, I think most of that planning came about from my wife Mary Jane and Blanche Dukart, who were very initially involved with the museum during the process of getting it ready for a museum, developing the house, changing the structure of the house. And then they were charged with the responsibility of coming up with things that would be suitable for a house of this period. And so between the two of them, Blanche Dukart and my wife Mary Jane, they learned about the Baylor family and their homespun ideas of doing things the old-fashioned way. And they asked them about it, and they was anxious to do things like that. Like the open hearth cooking, they wore the period clothes, and I think some of those clothes they probably made themselves, and if not, they had someone make them for them. So when they had these, usually it was once or twice a year, as I recall, when they had this, we had it in the kitchen, and the fireplace that's in the kitchen was used for the cooking. And they would demonstrate maybe quilting or weaving or wool making, because I recall these three girls were all very knowledgeable about doing old-fashioned projects, doing it the old-fashioned way. And that went on, I think, for 3 or 4 years. The girls, of course, the Baylor girls, grew up and got married, had families of their own, and I'm not sure whether it was 4 or 5 years that it was done. And then that was the, then there was a long period of time between that time and the recent years where it's been renewed and now it's being done again.
How many daughters?
Three daughters.
Do you remember anything about the Christmas programs, the original Christmas programs? Because in the minutes it said that Mrs. Dugard and Mr. Miller will arrange for the first Christmas program that was held in 1975, and they had an Elizabethtown Recorder concert was there for the music. Do you remember anything specifically about the first Christmas program?
Well, it was very simple from the way we do it today. The Elizabethan Recorder Consort was our first musical entertainment, and they was made available to us through my association with Potomac Playmakers and Mrs. Hewitt, who was the leader of that group at that period of time. And I approached her about doing